Well, good morning, everyone. Today is, what day is today? The 25th of August, 2014. And we're going to be beginning program number 16. And we're dealing with the Rays and the Initiations webinar commentary on part two. I went on quite a search the other day to see what I had done, because in a special section of the Treatise on Cosmic Fire video commentary, I covered a lot of the material in the Rays and the Initiations, all on the seven cosmic paths, and I covered that in detail. So when we get to those sections, there's one section that begins on page 395, and another that begins on page 413. I'm going to recommend that you go to the video commentaries on the ray, on the paths of the higher evolution, on the way of the higher evolution, which already exists within the Cosmic Fire video commentary. Now, we're at the point when we're talking about here the individual becoming a Shambhala recipient. And they are the higher initiations, even beginning from the third, when, in a sense, the first contact with the real will via the monad, and thus with Shambhala, is made. I'll get my bracket here, and we'll go on. In explanation, it might be said that the radiation of the hierarchy, which is definitely second ray, you know, it's the great heart center of our planet, second ray in nature, and which is projected as attractive radiation. Notice that, therefore, the radiation is magnetic as well, is implemented by the magnetic aspect. So this is important. Attractive radiation contains within itself the magnetic aspect. This, as the old commentary puts it, is, quote, a point of focused fire found in the center of the jewel. It stirs to life the quality of love. So in other words, this is interesting. It has that Shambhalic quality to it, that will quality, but it results in radiation. Just as when you pass the electric current through the copper coil, you get magnetism. It is a point of focused fire found in the center of the jewel. It stirs to life the quality of love which permeates the ashram of the Lord. And notice this first ray part is stirring the second ray part to life. So the love is stirred to life. And that which comes through our own jewel in the lotus is coming from our own monad, and yet will operate in this way within our egoic lotus as if it were a little replica of the great ashram. It stirs to life the quality of love which permeates the ashram of the Lord. Radiation then can penetrate to other centers and to other lives, and thus the Lord is served. Because what has to happen is that people or souls have to be attracted to the hierarchy. This is one of the great tasks which hierarchy is undertaking at this time, drawing those who are ready towards the ashram. And DK encourages us to do this and tells us that the book Discipleship in the New Age, Volume 1, can assist us very much in this important task of drawing those who are ready towards the ashram for further training. So, again, as the old commentary puts it, this is a point of focused fire found in the center of the jewel. Sometimes the jewel in the lotus is spoken of as the central fire, as well as of the jewel. It is a point of focused fire found in the center of the jewel. And let's see. I think I have to be careful here, because it looks like I erased something when I did that. Here it is. It stirs to life the quality of love, which permeates the ashram of the Lord. That is very explicit, very clear. Radiation can then penetrate to other centers and to other lives, and thus the Lord is served. It is this point of focused dynamic will at the very heart of the hierarchy, which in reality implements the plan, and I would say, and renders the hierarchy extremely magnetic. Oh, that's magician. Okay. To put the matter as simply as possible, too simply to be entirely exact, yet near enough to the truth to be clarifying and helpful, it is this magnetic potency, this dynamic, active, and energizing will, which enables the hierarchy to move forward upon the eternal path, as some are attracted and begin to take the place of those who are within the hierarchy at the moment. The senior members are allowed to move on because someone to take their place, or at least to enter, is trained. Its functions might be listed as possible. So, as follows. Let me read this again just to stabilize it. It is this magnetic potency, this dynamic, active, and energizing will, you know, the central fire at the very heart of the jewel, which enables the hierarchy to move forward upon the path. And one would begin to think that there must be a correspondence to the jewel in the lotus within the hierarchy itself, something that is stimulated by Sanat Kumara and his presence within that jewel. Every chakra, and the hierarchy is a chakra in that sense, has a jewel in its center. Okay. So the functions, it looks like the functions of the hierarchy, though a magnetic potency, its functions may be listed as follows. It is the connecting energy. Yeah, it's the function of the energy which comes into the hierarchy. This from Shambhala. It is the function of the energy which enters hierarchy from Shambhala, from the stimulation of the Lord of the World. It is the connecting energy which comes from Shambhala and enlivens, literally and occultly understood, the ashram of Sanat Kumara, enlivens. So the hierarchy is enlivened by the energy of Shambhala. It is, in one sense, the higher correspondence to the prana, which enlivens the dense physical body of man. Well, all of this is occurring. This process is occurring within the cosmic etheric planes. And that's where this life-giving energy from the higher aspects of the cosmic etheric planes on which Shambhala is found, though in some senses it can be found throughout the cosmic etheric planes, but certainly on the logoic and monadic planes, comes this energy which enlivens the lower levels of the cosmic etheric planes. Let's say the atmic aspect where the first ray ashrams are found, and the Buddhic aspect where most of the other ashrams are found. Some few scientific ashrams, we're told, are still found on the higher mental plane. Okay, further. It is the stimulating factor which produces cohesion among the various ashrams. Cohesion and magnetism are related. Okay. And is one of the sources of the hierarchical unity, only one of the sources. So this energy coming in from Shambhala is one of the sources of hierarchical unity. So it enlivens and it produces or stimulates cohesion among the ashrams. Putting it in other words, it is the service of the plan which binds the seven ashrams with their subsidiary ashrams coherently into one great ashram. This is their motivating reason for being. The plan is the expression of the purpose or the will of God, and it is formulated by some of the higher members of hierarchy on behalf of the rest of hierarchy, and is then adapted according to the function of particular ray ashrams and subsidiary ashrams. This shambolic magnetism not only relates the ashrams to each other, but is also the potency which evokes the will or the first ray nature inherent in every man, but which is only consciously and definitely unfolded within the periphery of the great ashram. So before we stand within the periphery of the great ashram, we cannot consciously and definitely unfold the first ray nature of the will. So it evokes the will. So, it not only relates the ashram, but is also the potency which evokes the will of the first ray nature inherent in every man. So sometimes we think we are possessed of the will, but until we truly are standing in relationship to the ashram, we are not really infused by the will or understand its true nature. And further, this great energy, in a mysterious sense, it is the life of that seed or germ which will come to fruition in the third solar system, the solar system which will be ruled by divine will, and probably the solar logos will have a first ray personality at that time. Our solar logos presently has a, we are told, the secondary personality and the secondary soul. It retains its secondary soul, of course, in the next solar system, but then we'll probably express with the first ray personality, allowing that system to become a system of will. And if we go back, probably the previous solar system, which was the first major solar system, had the third ray as the personality ray. Okay, so it allows the, it's that seed or germ, it's will, really, solar logic will, which will come to fruition in the third solar system. In the center, which we call the race of men, the potency of intelligence developed in a previous solar system is brought to fruition, and the stirrings of the potency of love are felt, and this is probably now. In the center nearest, which is nearest to the Lord, the potencies of intelligence and love are expressed, and at the third initiation, the magnetic pull of this potency of will is effected. So in the council chamber, I suppose this means, in the council chamber, both the potencies of intelligence and love are brought to fruition. Of intelligence and love are expressed. And at the third initiation, the magnetic pull of the potency of will is expressed. The center nearest to the Lord, I wonder, it could be the council chamber, but on the other hand, it could be a hierarchy, which is closest to Shambhala. Anyway, intelligence and love are certainly deeply expressed in hierarchy, and the a person is a member, at least peripherally, of the hierarchy at the third degree, and then the potency of shambolic will is evoked within him. So that's what I think it means. The center, which is nearest to the Lord, is probably the hierarchy, and then in the center, where the will of God is known, and that is Shambhala, the intelligent, loving master, now responsive to the energy of will, because a master can approach Shambhala, even though only maybe masters of the first ray have the ability to come and go as they will, now responsive to the energy of the will, is faced with the seven paths Well, he is a Chohan at this point. Whereon that will can come to fruition and the units of love can be transferred because they also will and know. So whereon that will can come to fruition and the units of love can be transferred to those paths because they also will and know. So they love, will, and know as they travel the path, and on the way of higher evolution, the will comes to fruition. This is what we want to understand, and it develops in ways that we cannot, at this time, understand. We understand that it comes to fruition, but how it does that, we do not know, except that it does so in 7 or 9 different ways. They can then form part of the third solar system, so no matter what destination they may tend towards, they may be part of this third solar system. They can then form part of the third solar system, which will be definitely under the influences coming from the cosmic mental plane, just as the cosmic astral plane stimulates the energy of love and, I suppose, the cosmic physical plane of intelligence. Just as in this solar system, the energies coming from the cosmic astral plane have been the major influence, and we can say, because this is a system of love. And the great source of love is the true cosmic love, that is the cosmic astral plane. So, what we have here is a gradual progression. In a mysterious sense, this energy coming from Shambhala and at the heart of hierarchy or at the heart of the jewel, wherever that jewel is found, is the life or seed or germ which will come to fruition in the third solar system. And we, you know, you kind of wonder on these cosmic paths, which the members of the monads who are in this solar system, which they take, will they in some manner return to this solar system when it demonstrates as the third major incarnation of the solar logos? That will have made 6 incarnations altogether. And synthetically, in some way that transcends time, space, and exists in the eternal now, it may represent a 7th as well. There are some references from Master DK that seem to indicate that there will be 7 solar systems expressing through our solar logos, or our logo, solar logos will express through 7, and yet the next is the 6th and last. But when we begin to count synthetically, we can look at all of them in the eternal now and perhaps call it a 7th system. So in the center where the will of God is known, the intelligent loving master, and I'll say here, who may now be a Chohan, now responsive to the energy of will, is faced with 7 paths whereon that will can come to fruition. After all, it will require this will to travel on the cosmic planes and to understand what must be done on particular paths in relation to the planes or plane to which those paths lead. Cosmic astral, cosmic mental, and in one place, even the cosmic Buddhic plane, the 6th path leading to the cosmic Buddhic plane. And the units of love, which are members of the hierarchy, basically, which are members of the hierarchy, can be transferred because they also will and know. But with if they could not will, they could not be transferred. If they could not will in the divine sense, they could not be transferred. They could not escape the cosmic physical plane without the development of the will. They can then form part of the third solar system, and we wonder how many of those who go on the cosmic paths and I want to just say that here, how many of those who travel the way of higher evolution return to participate in the third solar system. Okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to make this one of those little third solar system. The abbreviations help later in the day. Right, and they can then form part of the solar system. But how many, actually, you know, it's interesting because there's kind of an analogy here. Those who from the first major solar system, that was the previous one, journeyed to Sirius to become solar angels, returned to a new incarnation of our solar system. And so we have to ask, will those who take other paths in this, following their participation in this second solar system, will they return to a new incarnation of our solar logos, which is called the third solar system? How magnetic and binding is the fact that the monad is that which finds its place within the sun? In other words, no matter where you go for education, do you come home? This is the question. All this is, of course, an inadequate expression of abstruse truth. The cosmic astral plane is not an illusion, as is the astral plane with which we are also unhappily acquainted. Apparently, that's where the major trouble is. The illusory nature of our astral plane has to do with the astral forms which have been formed by man's, shall we say, erroneously stimulated imaginative life. As I've said before, it seems to me there must be astral atoms. In other words, for a plane to exist, there has to be some sort of atomic substructure. So it seems to me that it's not an illusion in that sense. It's just that what has been created on it is illusory. But apparently, on the cosmic astral plane, whatever forms may there exist, and they would not be forms as we know them, certainly not concrete forms in the sense of our solar system, they would not be concrete forms. They are not illusory. So I would say that the forms or configurations there created on the cosmic astral plane are part of a greater plan and are not illusory and obstructive, as are the forms that are created on our astral plane, or at least so many of them. DK tells us much about the astral problem when he talks about all of us being so unhappily acquainted with these particular forms. So to me, there's quite a great mystery concerning what makes our astral plane, our systemic astral plane, unreal, though substantial. I would say this, you know, maybe I can summarize in this way. Our astral plane is an illusion, though it is also substantial. Meaning that it consists of atomic matter of certain, well, I shouldn't call it atomic matter, subtle matter of certain vibrations, because, you know, on every subplane, the different atoms are aggregated differently, vibrate differently. So we cannot say there's only one type of atom on the astral plane. There are so many different types of atoms right here on our physical plane, and we're told to be etheric atoms and atoms that go beyond all the way up on the cosmic physical plane until we reach the sort of ultimate unit, which we at the present call the bubble in the koilon. But the question is, are even those composite and Is there a cosmic astral matter? What is matter on that type of level? Okay, we cannot know. We don't know whether those higher cosmic planes are aggregated in the manner that our cosmic physical plane is formed of many aggregates. Anyway, the cosmic astral plane is not an illusion. That is what we are. That's our main point, and from it the great energy of love emanates. The reason for this lies in the fact that all our planes constitute the cosmic physical plane and are therefore regarded, as far as three worlds of human evolution are concerned, as illusion. Well, this is interesting because it is mainly the non-principled dense physical vehicle of any entity, whether it's a cosmic entity or a human entity, which is considered to be illusory. Because it is not principled, it has to be aggregated according to the energy configurations which lie above it and which are not illusory, let us say, and which are reflective of the archetypes in the plan. So all of our planes, the reason the astral plane, well, the physical plane would also be illusory, and so would the lower mental plane, and even from the solar point of view, the higher mental plane, our normal higher mental plane, because it is part of the dense physical vehicle of the solar logos, might be considered illusory. Anyway, our astral plane is illusory for various reasons. The reason for this lies in the fact that all our planes constitute the cosmic physical plane and are therefore regarded, as far as the three worlds of human evolution are concerned, as illusion. Maybe not from the point of view of the cosmic ethers, for the dense physical substance is not a principle. Well, that's the whole idea. If a certain vibratory level is unprincipled, it's considered illusory also. So let me just kind of summarize that and say, a vibratory level which is relatively unprincipled is considered illusory. That in terms of the planetary logos, I believe it's the lower 18 subplanes, and in terms of the solar logos, it is the lower 21 subplanes, which makes even our egoic lotus illusory from or unprincipled from the solar logoic point of view. In other words, the solar logoic principles really begin in the cosmic ethers and not below. This you have often told. The cosmic astral plane is a reservoir of love energy pouring into two of our planes, which constitute part of the cosmic etheric body, the monadic plane and the buddhic plane, particularly those, that's the two and the four, and we always know that in occultism, the two and the four are closely related, even to the point that a number of fourth ray souls transfer on to the second ray. Some do not, but others do. So there is a connection here, between the cosmic astral plane, the monadic plane, the buddhic plane, and then the astral plane itself, which has to become disillusioned or deglamorized, as it were. Right now we're talking about this energy, which is at the very center of the jewel, in both within the hierarchy, and within man himself. So we're talking about how Shambhala affects hierarchy. This is largely our subject right now. Our subject here is principally how the Shambhala energy affects hierarchy. So it is that which permeates the radiation from the hierarchy to which humanity is responsive. Remember, it's a great enlivening energy, and even when we speak about our vitality and our enthusiasm, ultimately we can probably trace it to this cosmic vitality and the will which exerts itself in Shambhala. It is that which permeates the radiation from the hierarchy to which humanity is responsive. No disciple or aspirant can be drawn into the periphery of the hierarchy, as DK did with a number of his students, and from thence into an ashram without finding that his will nature is being affected. So as we come closer to hierarchy, the Shambhalic power that is pouring through the hierarchical vibrations strengthens our will nature. It will only show itself at this stage as persistence and determination. Persistence is a quality of life. After all, reality persists forever. Persistence is a quality of life and related to immortality. And we do remember, let the forces come together, let them mount the high place, and from that lofty eminence, let the soul look out upon a world destroyed, and then that being sounds the mantra, I still persist. Sometimes, I think there's a typo there in different parts of the books. At one point it says, I will persist. I think I still persist is the correct one. And I will is incorrect because it talks about something that has not yet been accomplished, whereas this mantra speaks of that which has been accomplished. I'll just go here and I'll do these words. Lofty eminence, and let the forces come together, let them mount to the high place, and from that lofty eminence, let the soul look out upon a world destroyed, then let the word go forth. I still persist. So it is a quality, DK tells us, of the will. Persistence is a quality of life and related to immortality, whilst determination is the lowest aspect of the will. So here we have a discrimination between persistence and determination. So the will be affected, and as we are drawn towards the ashram, the sense of persistence increases in us, and our determination is also augmented in its power. And we get the sense of being that immortal being that does persist throughout cosmos, and really persists forever as cosmoses come and go. Their development, that is, persistence and determination, produces a reorientation which becomes a permanent attitude, and the disciple then becomes responsive not only to the vitalized radiation coming from the periphery of hierarchy, this is the Shambhalic radiation-infusing hierarchy, but also in an increasing measure to the magnetic pull which emanates from the hierarchy itself, and in particular from the ashram to which he must eventually find his way. Okay. So there is Shambhalic energy pouring through the hierarchy, stimulating hierarchy, and it reaches the disciple, and he begins to develop within himself a sort of a permanent attitude of persistence and determination. Okay. Permanent attitude of persistence and determination. And so that vitalized radiation is stimulating the will. Probably Atma in him, the spiritual will, is stimulated just as the cosmic astral plane is stimulating the monad, monadic love and the buddhi. So there's 1, 3, 5, 7 lines of descent coming from the willful nature of the cosmic mental plane, ultimately, and then the 2, 4, 6 line coming from the cosmic astral plane. All of this, all of these things are the result, all of this is the result of Shambhalic energy entering the domain of hierarchy and the correspondence in man of hierarchy. his soul nature. So the soul nature is going to become infused with the monadic nature. In this lower correspondence to Shambhala, infusing with its energy the hierarchy and affecting hierarchical radiation. So in hierarchy, as a result of the Shambhala influence, we have vitalized radiation and magnetic pull. Of course, the magnetic pull would come anyway, but what we've seen is that a greater magnetism is induced because of the shambolic influence. So in these days, as we are being drawn towards the hierarchy, the shambolic influence is having a strong contribution to that magnetic process. We have basically, what we have learned is that magnetism is an admixture of shambolic energy as it affects hierarchical energy. It's a combination of the first and the second ray. I think he's made that point very clear to us, wouldn't you say so? If you will make a close study of all the above information, you may find some measure of enlightenment. Enlightenment is not sudden, something that happens suddenly and finally and forever. It is a gradual intensification, and I think, you know, that a number of the current ways of spiritual training, let's say Zen or let's say other forms of Buddhism, which speak of the enlightenment of the Satori or of the illumination, have to take this into consideration. It's not a final thing, it's just the first stage. So, let's see here. Okay. The enlightenment. Okay, how about that? Enlightenment, of which we normally speak, is but the first stage of a process which leads to greater and greater light. And, it's always the nature of man to want to have the struggle cease, to arrive and to have the sense of having arrived forever and no more effort would be required. You know, that's a bit like the heaven consciousness. I get to heaven and that's it. I'm enlightened and that's it. I have the experience of Satori, of illumination, and that's it. But it's not. It's an ever and ever ongoing process, cyclically undertaken, with the realization between universal cycles, the cycles in which the universe exists, that absoluteness is forever. And to it, nothing can be added or subtracted. It makes for a very interesting theory about how this cosmos and its absolute origin function. Well, that would lead me off, you know, if I get into speculations about absoluteness, which about which one is perhaps not supposed to speculate. But I do call it the infinity of all infinities, and I do believe that to it nothing can be added or subtracted, multiplied, divided. All of those mathematical processes which deal with number do not apply in absoluteness, in infinitude, absolute infinitude. And by that I mean absolute infinitude negates number. So it is as it is forever, without beginning and without end, and we be that, if I may say. We be that. We are that forever, but we be that periodically, without the other, without any other, and by other I mean a universe. Of course, the universe essentially is not other, but it seems to be. So we live as that without seeming. periodically. We live as that without any taint of seeming. Of course, everything that can be said here can be contradicted when one thinks more deeply about the absolute, but periodically, I at least as I presently conceive it, we live entirely as that, without any taint of seeming. The universe is a seeming. Okay. Anyway, if you will make a close study of all the above information, you may find some measure of enlightenment. It is the great simplicities which must be ever kept in mind, because, you know, over-involvement in complexity is itself the cause of illusion and prevents us from seeing the great and abiding truths and realities. The three great divine aspects, the septenates of the evolutionary process, the divine qualities or principles, and the relation of energy to force. These, I think he's calling these the great simplicities, the three great divine aspects, the septenates of the evolutionary process. Always the three and the seven go together. It's going to make a ten. The divine qualities or principles and the relation of energy to force, these are the great simplicities. Okay? These are the great simplicities. With these clearly held in mind, the detail is of small moment. The intuition rapidly assimilates and relates the detail in this sense. It is Mercurian. If there be need to do so, to the manifesting whole. So all the detail is related to each other and to the manifesting whole by the intuition, Mercurian in nature in this respect, if there be need to do so. Okay. Well, this means that when we do develop our intuition, so much that we struggle to know at this time will be conferred rapidly, maybe even instantaneously, by the intuition. So it becomes very important then to develop the intuition, and even more important to do that than to study endlessly, though the right kind of study, let us say, can bring us to the development of the intuition. Okay, so moving on then. To return to our theme, which is the expression of the great ashram through the medium of the seven ashrams, that is, of the major hierarchy through its ashrams, it is this magnetic energy of the first aspect, which is found at the heart of the seven ashrams, and so in a sense the master must embody it and express it. And energized and enlightened from the reservoir of will energy found at the heart of the great ashram itself, having been contributed by Shambhala. So rereading this, you know, some of these things really have to be reread because they are so deep, you know, and we have to let them sink in. To return to our theme, which is the expression of the great ashram through the medium of the seven ashrams, it is this magnetic energy of the first aspect which is found at the heart of the seven ashrams, energized and enlightened from the reservoir of will energy found at the heart of the great ashram itself. And that has been contributed by Shambhala, as we have been discussing. It is this enlivening which goes to the center of this great second ray center, hierarchy, or in a way every ashram is a second ray center, whatever its ray may be, because it is an aspect of hierarchy. This reservoir, he's summarizing here, we see, this reservoir is fed from the center where the will of God is known, and the directing agent of this energy within the hierarchy itself is the Christ and his two associates, the Manu and the Maha Chohan. And what can we say of them? They are the directors and the coordinators. They are both. So this reservoir, a reservoir of will energy found at the heart of the great ashram itself. It needs, the great ashram needs this for its continuing stimulation and enlivening. This reservoir is fed from the center where the will of God is known. And Christ and the two great beings are the directors and coordinators, the Manu and the Maha Chohan. The 49 subsidiary ashrams, not all of which are yet functioning, he gets into this a little bit later, are energized by the potency of will from the reservoir of energy at the heart of each major ashram. And so it is passed on. A certain intensity of the energy found at the heart of the great ashram is found at the center of each major ashram, each ray ashram. And I suppose, you know, it's going to be passed on to every one of the, it will be passed on to every one of the subsidiary ashrams. The 49 subsidiary ashrams are energized by the potency of will from the reservoir of energy at the heart of each major ashram, and then they too, each of these 49, will also have a reservoir of will to be passed on to those initiates and disciples which the subsidiary ashram energizes. These in their turn being fed by from the central reservoir. So we get this idea of will being passed from center to center, each center being of lesser potency, but still part of that continuity of will, which flows from Shambhala. The correspondence of this in the human centers is called the jewel and the lotus, and ultimately we have to realize that the jewel and the lotus is connected then to Shambhala. So when we look for our soul power and we seek at the very center of our being, the source of will, we look for the jewel and the lotus, and we try to sense that central fire fed from the correspondence within us to Shambhala, which is the monad itself. So let us now study the formation of the great ashram, and then this will have more meaning for you. The gradual formation of the seven ashrams under direct ray activity. You know, when Master DK deals with matters which are too high above us, too abstruse, well, we learn of these things and we make note of them, but we can only theorize about them and we cannot really apply the information to our life immediately, though I must say having these things in mind does make a difference in our appreciation of what is transpiring spiritually on this planet. So let us now study the formation of the great ashram, and then, this will have more meaning for you, the gradual formation of the seven ashrams under direct ray activity. This process lies in the past history of humanity, and I shall only briefly touch upon it. Once formed, it became the task of these seven ashrams to produce the 42 ashrams, the six subsidiary. For every major center, there are six subsidiary. You know, you see in geometry the configuration. Let's say you take seven pennies, or seven nickels, whatever. You put one in the center and only six can surround it. It makes kind of a hexagon. And that's simply the law in our system. So the six subsidiary, which are the 42 subsidiary, with the major seven making the 49, is the archetypal formation of the ashrams, numerically considered. These seven ashrams express ray qualities, and the whole 49 are expressive of the 49 fires referred to in the secret doctrine. Through these fires, the fire of God, the God of fire, seeks to make himself known. Well, there are 49 fires related to Brahma. There are also 49 fires related to Vishnu, and I would say related to Shiva as well. They are called, the sons of Fohat are responsible for the 49 fires of Brahma, the sons of Vishnu for the 49 fires of the second aspect, and if there are sons of Shiva, or there are seven spirits of darkness, and they bring about 49 fires related to their own first ray nature. He has dealt with this in a treatise on cosmic fire, and I have, well, how can one comment very much about it? One can't, but I've said a little something about it in the written commentaries. As far as the spirits of darkness expressing the first ray, we can know very little, but we're trying to come in touch with the seven major ray lords and their 42 subsidiaries. As we study, As we study some of the esoteric details connected with the life, the quality, and later the appearance of the ashrams of the master, the life, the central will, the quality, the differentiated notes, of which there are seven major, and the appearance, more through form. As we study these things, I would remind you of certain points I have already made. Your minds then will be predisposed to right thinking and right interpretation, with the correct reminders in mind. I am anxious for your approach to the subject to be correct. I have given you a number of definitions of an ashram in the previous pages and in my other books, and it would be worthwhile, I think, just taking a compilation on the ashram and seeing all the different ways he has looked at this. We had one very important definition, which I'm forgetting at the moment, which we just dealt with a few pages earlier. I've given you a number of definitions of an ashram in the previous pages and in my other books, and I would have you bear these in mind. The concept of a college group or band of workers, or of a number of men and women working under the supervision of a master, is apt to color your thought. I hope he's not speaking of the Maurya College here. Well, sometimes I think he anticipates what we're going to do in years far ahead, and who are the workers and what they will be inclined to bring forth. And I think he speaks to them so that he can reach them and make sure they stay on track. So the concept of a college group, of a band of workers, or of a number of men and women working under the supervision of a master is too apt to color your thoughts. The complete freedom from all coercion or from any supervision of daily activity, the instinctive reaction of all within the ashram to the ray influence and to the breathing of the prevailing breath of the prevailing will, as it is called, is something very different. So this is a truer view of the ashram, not a collegiate group studying under a master and making progress through their studies. Well, maybe we somewhat have that view in mind. Perhaps that is what we do to a degree. But this is a deeper presentation. The complete freedom from all coercion or from any supervision of daily activity, maybe of internal activities. There is supervision, as D.K. showed when he wrote to his students. He hesitated to supervise their life on the outer planes, though to a degree, when there was a great necessity, he did that. The complete freedom from all coercion or from any supervision of daily life, the instinctive reaction of all within the ashram to the ray influence. If we're in a particular ashram and the ray prevails, we automatically somehow follow that ray and express that ray. The instinctive reaction to the breathing, to the breath of the prevailing will of the master at the heart of the ashram, representing the monad, and ultimately taking this breath from Shambhala, and Shambhala taking it from greater sources, and on. So the instinctive reaction to the breath of the prevailing will, as it is called, is something very different. I seek in what I intend to impart to you to give a very different impression. In our next section on the dual life of the initiatory process, the newer concepts may emerge more clearly. Not only the dual life of discipleship, but the dual life of the initiatory process. The points I would have you bear in mind are as follows. And then he goes into 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, a lot of points related to the ashram. And I think this might be something we want to take up next time with program number 17. So this will be the end of Rays and Initiation Webinar Commentary Program 15, and it was page 375. And let's see where we are. I always forget the previous page number. 2379. That's where we are. 375, 379. We're sort of going about four pages at a time now. And we'll be beginning of Rays and Initiation Webinar Commentary Program. This was Program 16 we began with, I'm pretty sure. Ah, yes, program 16. Yes, so now it's program 17, and we'll begin with page 379. And all of these newer concepts relating to the ashram, 379, with newer concepts rotating. Right, we'll do that. And now I think we just have a very few minutes. Why don't we close with the great invocation? I think it'd be a good thing to do. Yeah, we'll do that. Okay. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men, let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Oh. Okay, friends, it's a great book, and we're getting started on those things about which we will know much more before too many centuries elapse. See you soon with Program 17. Bye-bye.